Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 28th of March, these are our main stories. An about-turn by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on cancelling talks with the White House over plans to attack Rafah in Gaza.
Now we are told, you can't do this. If you go into Rafah, you're going to have a humanitarian catastrophe. 30,000 civilian dead. That is simply not true.
1 billion meals worldwide are thrown away every day, according to the United Nations. And Myanmar's military is accused of using social media that resulted in mass attacks on ethnic Rohingyas.
It was a really violent, chilling time. The UN has now said it's a textbook example of ethnic cleansing.
Also in this podcast.
I was walking out of class, sending a text to a friend, and then just got clocked in the face.
Just texted my friends, just got punched in the face, and then they sent me a TikTok of this other girl in New York who got punched in the face.
A disturbing uptick in women being physically assaulted in New York, and fury in France over the resignation of a head teacher who got death threats for enforcing the compulsory ban on Islamic headscarves. Just days after the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu cancelled a visit to Washington by some of his top officials, he's changed his mind. He took the original decision on Monday after the United States appeared to turn its back on Israel by not blocking a United Nations Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. The visit by Israeli officials is to discuss a planned military offensive against Hamas in Rafah. The US has warned against the operation because of the humanitarian cost. That view was reiterated by the State Department spokesman Matthew Miller.
A full-scale military operation into Rafah would be a mistake, and it's not something that we can support. What we have said is the kind of mission that we could support is a much more targeted, limited campaign that could still achieve the same objectives, that could still lead to the defeat of those remaining Hamas battalions inside Rafah, but without massive harm to the civilian population, without hindering the delivery of humanitarian assistance.
In Israel, Prime Minister Netanyahu brushed aside worries about potentially huge numbers of civilian deaths.
Victory is within reach. It's a few weeks away. This is it, last point. Now we are told, you can't do this. If you go into Rafah, you're going to have a humanitarian catastrophe. You're going to have, 30,000 dead. 30,000 civilian dead. Okay. That's not true. That is simply not true.
So what was it that prompted Mr. Netanyahu to change his mind? Our correspondent in Jerusalem is Hugo Beshega.
I think what is interesting is that after Prime Minister Netanyahu cancelled the visit on Monday, the White House said it was an overreaction. The Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant had meetings in Washington this week. Senior American officials, he said those meetings were productive. So perhaps this U-turn by the Prime Minister is the result of those meetings. But I think what's been quite clear here is the growing frustration in the Biden administration with the way Israel has been conducting this war. And I think the feeling that Israel is not listening to the concerns that have been shared by its closest ally. The Americans are saying, look, too many Palestinians have been killed and that more needs to be done to step up the delivery of humanitarian aid amid warnings of famine in parts of Gaza. But we haven't really seen any dramatic change in the Israeli strategy.
The talks are about a possible offensive in Rafah. The US wants to see clear plans first. What more do you know?
Yeah, so essentially what Prime Minister Netanyahu says is that the Israeli military must enter Rafah to defeat Hamas. This is where the Israelis say 4 Hamas battalions remain operational. The problem, of course, is that this is the last relatively safe place in Gaza where more than 1 million Palestinians are sheltering after being forced to flee their homes. And the Israelis say they have a plan to safely evacuate civilians. But I guess virtually everyone outside Israel opposes the idea of a major incursion into Rafah. The UN is saying that this would lead to a humanitarian catastrophe, something that Netanyahu talked about in the clip. The Americans say this would lead to a disaster. So the Americans are saying they have alternatives to a major incursion and that they want to discuss these possibilities with the Israelis.
So is it going to happen?
Well, we still don't know. The Prime Minister is adamant that this is going to go ahead, that this is the only way to defeat Hamas.
Hugo Bashega in Jerusalem. How much food gets wasted worldwide each day? The equivalent of 1 billion meals a day, according to a new report by the United Nations. The organisation says it's a global tragedy that we waste almost one-fifth of the food we produce at a time when almost 800 million people face chronic hunger. Gaza is one such place where 1 million people are on the brink of famine. Nigeria is also battling food insecurity as Africa's largest economy is gripped by high inflation, pushing millions into poverty. Among them is 68-year-old Damilola Salami. She spoke outside a food bank in Lagos.
There's nothing for us to eat. We are hungry. Our children are out of school because of the hike in fees. Now the children are at home and we have nothing to feed them. Please have mercy.
But who is responsible and is it a trend that can be reversed? I spoke to our environment correspondent Matt McGrath.
The driving forces behind what's causing this food waste is a growing element of this, which is not just the richer countries wasting lots of food, but it's also developing countries wasting lots of food as well. A global problem that doesn't seem to be getting better. And you might have thought with global populations growing up, then getting larger, then effectively we'd be wasting less food. But it doesn't seem to be the case. We're wasting massive amounts of food and it's having huge impacts, not just on nature and on pollution, but on the climate as well. The estimation is that about 8 to 10% of global emissions come from wasting food. It's crazy in some respects. If food waste was a country, it would be the third biggest emitter behind the US and China, just to put it in context for people. So it's an obvious problem. There's lots of things that people talk about wanting to do about it, and some things are being done. We see in richer countries, there are greater efforts to improve refrigeration, not to have so much waste, to cut down on best before dates and other warnings about expiry dates that are manufacturers are trying to get rid of those in many places. In developing countries, there's greater efforts at refrigeration because that's where the big losses are, the lack of refrigeration, a lot of food waste lost in transit as well. So there's various ways of tackling this problem, but the problem still seems to be ongoing. The researcher said the more we look at this problem, the more we discover about it and the more food we see is being wasted.
And this is one of those rare problems where all of us can actually do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the first thing that the UN says about this is that really, if countries start to count how much is wasted, they can really then start to make some progress. Only about 20 countries count food waste in their climate plans to cut down on climate change, and that is possible to make changes. Richer countries like the UK and Japan have cut down food waste significantly. Japan down by about a third in the last few years by putting in place better plans. But it's a real challenge. Food is cheap in many countries and there's no real penalties for people throwing it away. And that, unfortunately, despite so many people going hungry, is the tragedy of the situation.
Matt McGrath. Haiti's presidential council has promised to restore public order and democracy once it's installed, which is expected to happen in the next few days. In its first official statement, the council said it would appoint a new prime minister to organise presidential and congressional elections, which are long overdue. Illegal weapons from abroad are fueling the gun violence. The United Nations has warned that arms trafficking, particularly from the US, has powered the gangs who've taken over, displacing thousands of people. Our correspondent Nomir Iqbal sent this report from Cap Haitian.
The capital of this volatile nation is a war zone. For a country that doesn't manufacture weapons, every type of gun is flooding Port-au-Prince. High-powered rifles such as AK-47s, 9mm pistols, sniper rifles, belt-fed machine guns. It's the main cause of a staggering surge in Haiti's gang-related violence. Juliet has faced that violence firsthand. She used to work as a party planner in Port-au-Prince. An event she had catered for was ambushed by gangs.
I said to everyone, run, because they are shooting. And then I was shot twice.
Juliet shows me the bullet scars on her arm and chest. She sobs as she recalls how 10 people were killed, including her 22-year-old business partner. She fled to Cap Haitien, carrying her suitcase and scars.
At the beginning, our political leaders didn't do anything to stop these gangs. The gangs are everywhere.
The 50-year-old now lives in a small space, sharing a bed with a friend. She can't go back to her home because gangs have moved in.
Cape Haitien is the only safe place I know of in Haiti right now.
That safe haven is why buses keep coming into Cap Haitien every day, braving the dangerous drive along gang-controlled roads. More than 30,000 people have desperately fled the violence in the capital, paying high prices to make the journey here. There is a moment of relief as one father sees his 14-year-old son climb down the stairs with his bag. David is safe.
The journey was very long, more than 6 hours. I was praying the whole way. There were a lot of gunshots in one area. Our bus just missed them.
People on the bus are exhausted and upset. One man says he has a message for America.
All the guns here are from the U.S. If the U.S. want to stop this, they could do it in 1 month.
There is no exact number for how many trafficked firearms are currently in Haiti. A UN report in January said some estimates put it at 500 million legal and illegal weapons here as of 2020. It's 50 guns for every person living in a country with a population of just over 11 million. The US State Department announced a plan last year to work with Haitian police to tackle gun trafficking. But there is no head of state right now, effectively no government, and a yet-to-be-announced presidential transitional council that's already been viewed by many people here with suspicion. It means gun violence is yet another vicious circle Haiti is trapped in, with no clear way out.
Nomia Iqbal reporting from Cap Haitien. The head of the European Council, Charles Michel, has accused Russia of lying in its attempts to link last week's attack on a concert hall in Moscow to Ukraine. The comments come after the Belarusian president, Alexander Lukashenko, said the attackers had tried to flee to his country first rather than head straight to Ukraine, as the Kremlin had suggested. Our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, has more details.
The comments by Alexander Lukashenko throw direct doubt on Russia's claims that Ukraine was somehow involved in the Crocus City attack. Speaking to state media, the Belarusian leader said as soon as his country's security service knew that the gunmen were fleeing west from Moscow, Russia asked Belarus to close the border. Mr. Lukashenko says the attackers then realized they couldn't cross, so headed for Ukraine instead. The problem is that's nothing like Vladimir Putin's story, that Ukraine had supposedly opened a window on its own border for the attackers to escape through. Officials in Kiev have called that claim absurd from the very start, and Russia has never produced any evidence. But even today, the foreign ministry spokeswoman in Moscow tried to undermine the fact that the so-called Islamic State group has said it carried out this attack by saying it was hard to believe ISIS would have had the capacity. That is classic Russian style, to muddy the waters, make unsubstantiated claims, and try to deflect all possible criticism from Vladimir Putin. In fact, that's what the Belarusian leader claimed he was trying to do with his own comments. He wanted people to know how busy the two presidents had been in the wake of the attack, coordinating their response. Instead, he's undermined Vladimir Putin's whole story. Maybe it was a blunder, maybe not. Alexander Lukashenko sometimes likes to remind Moscow that he's no one's puppet.
Sarah Rainsford. The almost year-long conflict that's been raging in Sudan has left tens of thousands dead and displaced more than 7 million people, the highest number in the world. With the help of outside support, it's pitted the Sudanese army under General Burhan against General Himeti of the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Now, the Sudanese army has ordered the ambassador of the United Arab Emirates to leave over its alleged support for the RSF. John Prendergast co-founded the investigative and policy organisation called The Sentry with Hollywood A-lister George Clooney. He explained how Sudan's rapid support forces have been using gold to fund its war to Julian Marshall.
They have been exporting most of their gold, particularly from Darfur, into the United Arab Emirates gold markets for years now. So when the split occurred between the government and the militia, they continued to export their gold to the Emirates. And basically, there's an unholy triangle between the RSF, the Wagner Group, now called the Africa Corps, the Russia's paramilitary organization, and the Emirati gold traders to launder Sudanese gold through the Emirates markets. And much of the cash then goes back to Russia to help fund its war in Ukraine. And some of the money, of course, comes to the RSF.
And does it work in the same way from territory controlled by General Burhan and the Sudanese army?
We're still trying to get a full handle on that, but it seems like a lot of the gold that Egypt is bringing in is being smuggled across the border from Sudanese government-controlled territory into Egypt, and then Egypt monetizes that, sells it into the international markets, so probably through Dubai. So yeah, they're getting it from a different source, but most of it actually ends up going through the gold markets in Dubai.
And this illegal gold trade could, in your view, be stopped?
Stopped would be too extreme, but I think it certainly could be undermined and could be countered. Part of it is just public pressure. If we look back, say, 20 years, when the genocide erupted in Darfur, no less a power as China had its policy impacted by accusations of funding and supporting a genocide in Darfur. Well, now we're back again to genocidal violence in Darfur. And now it's the United Arab Emirates that is the funder of the group that is responsible for that.
The Secretary General of the Goldsmiths Union in the UAE, Atif Ahmed, has confirmed ongoing shipments to the UAE and the processing of others. So there is an acknowledgement by the UAE that gold is entering the territory, but it also adds, this is at a governmental level, that the UAE does not take sides in the current conflict. And you would rebut that?
I might, but more importantly, the UN panel of experts focused on these issues provided evidence, and many other sources have confirmed and reconfirmed the various means by which the Emirates have delivered weapons to the RSF. It's a fairly well-established fact, despite their denials.
John Prendergast speaking to Julian Marshall. Still to come in the Global News Podcast. There's a darkness on the edge of town. Bruce Springsteen is set to become the first foreigner to be inducted as a fellow of the UK's prestigious Ivors Academy. A United Nations report has found clear evidence that the military authorities in Myanmar used social media to spread fear and hatred for the Rohingya minority ahead of the crackdown against them in 2017. Our Asia-Pacific regional editor Celia Hatton told me more.
What the Myanmar military sickeningly called clearance operations took place in August 2017. That's when there was a massive crackdown on an ethnic group inside Myanmar, Muslim Rohingyas. Tensions have long been really high between the governing military and the Rohingyas who live in Rakhine State. In August 2017, violence really picked up. We now believe 7,000 to 10,000 people were killed in about a month. Tens of thousands of people were raped and tortured, and hundreds of thousands of Rohingyas fled and went to neighboring Bangladesh. It was a really violent, chilling time. The UN has now said it's a textbook example of ethnic cleansing took place at that time.
Those people who fled to Bangladesh are still in Bangladesh, still in refugee camps. What's this UN report saying about the use of social media by the Myanmar military?
Well, Facebook is uniquely popular in Myanmar. Most people in Myanmar use it if they have access to the internet. And so they looked at 43 Facebook pages between those months, July and December, tens of thousands of posts. And what they've realized is that there was a secret covert network run by the military, all written by the military, anonymous posts, all promoting hatred of the Rohingya and promoting false allegations that the Rohingya threatened other ethnic groups inside Myanmar and Buddhism itself. Some of these posts were on celebrity gossip pages, news pages, but actually it was this covert network, the UN says, all written by the military.
Celia Hatton. Women in New York City are encouraging each other to be vigilant after reports of some being punched in the street. Multiple incidents have happened within days of each other, and the victims have been posting their stories on TikTok. Stephanie Prentice reports.
The incident started being reported on the 19th of March when the comedian Sarah Harvard was walking alone in Lower Manhattan and was suddenly punched in the back of her head. In the following days, multiple young women on TikTok started uploading videos with a very similar story. They were walking alone, distracted on their smartphone, and suddenly hit in the head by a man who quickly ran away.
I'm like shaking, trying to tell this story. I was walking out of the Times Square station and a random man came up and punched me in the head.
I was like walking out of class, sending a text to a friend, and then just got clocked in the face.
Oh my God, it hurts so bad. I can't even talk. I fell to the ground and now this giant goose egg is forming.
I just texted my friends being like, hi, just got punched in the face. And then they sent me a TikTok of this other girl in New York who got punched in the face. And I don't know if this is like a thing that's going around.
I was part of a group of women that got punched. What?
Some accounts also claim that the man greeted them before attacking, with many of them reporting the incidents around downtown Manhattan in the Lower East Side, East Village and Union Square areas. Their injuries include head wounds, black eyes and concussions. The women have been sharing information with each other about the attacker's description.
I have been able to identify that this man is the same as who hit a couple other girls. But what's even scarier is, like, there's a lot of girls and our descriptions of this man are completely different, meaning this, like, there's multiple men going around and doing this.
The victims say they've all now spoken to the police after seeing each other's stories and an investigation is underway. But they're warning other women that, in their words, as well as being cautious at night, they now need to be cautious in broad daylight.
Stephanie Prentice. Politicians in France have expressed their solidarity with a Paris head teacher who resigned after he said he received death threats for asking students to remove their Islamic head coverings. In an interview on French television, the Prime Minister, Gabriel Attal, said the French state would always stand with officials who are facing breaches of secularism in educational establishments, and it would pursue legal action against a pupil about the allegations. Our Paris correspondent, Hugh Schofield, told me more.
It was about a month ago in this big secondary school in eastern Paris, and the head teacher, we don't know his name, came across three teenage girls who were wearing the Islamic headscarf. That's against the law in France. In state schools, you have to remove any ostentatious sign of religious affiliation. So he told them to take them off. Two of them agreed, but one girl didn't, and there was some kind of row, altercation, after which the head teacher started getting death threats. There was a kind of online hate campaign targeting him, threatening him with killing him. And he has decided now that he needs to resign, that his life has become too much at threat. And it seems like it's early retirement. He's obviously getting close to the age of retirement. And the Education Ministry is putting that spin on it, saying, yes, he's decided for his own reasons to step down early. But in his email to fellow staff members, he says quite clearly, I'm doing this for my own safety and for the safety of the school. So as far as the kind of body politic of France is concerned, it's a case of a senior educationalist, a head teacher of respect, with a long years of service, being forced to leave his job because of an online campaign of hate threatening him with death.
Politics is so divisive generally at the moment in France. But as I understand it, this has pretty much united all parties.
Yeah, it is doubly sensitive because we have a track record here of attacks on teachers. There are two very well-known and terrible cases in the recent years of teachers being killed by Islamists. The most notably, of course, Samuel Paty, who had his head cut off in Paris suburb by an Islamist because he'd shown cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad to his class. So that is why there is such sensitivity among the teaching profession, and I think that communicates itself across the country. There was a demonstration of fellow head teachers in support of this head teacher just a couple of weeks ago before he resigned, and the message from these collected head teachers from Paris was, we are all to some degree or another facing this kind of issue all the time. Maybe not as explicit as this, but it's happening and it's getting worse. And so, yes, on the political front, everyone has condemned what's happening because it's a shocking state of affairs when a man whose job it is to oversee a school and to make sure that égalité, laïcité, that means keeping religion out of schools, that these rules are applied, and he was applying them, that he then has to give up because he's under the threat of murder.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. Tourism accounts for roughly half of the tiny Pacific island nation of Palau's total GDP. During COVID, that industry was shattered and Palau lost around a fifth of its GDP. Things are slowly recovering, but Palau is still struggling to restart its flight routes with key tourism markets, as the BBC's Frey Lindsay discovered.
Hi, how you doing?
This is the MK Hotel and Restaurant on Malakal Island in Palau, a small island nation in Micronesia in the Western Pacific Ocean. Tyler Shin is the owner.
We have our own private beach.
Looking at the kind of beach that looks like you would see on a postcard. Gleaming blue water and
it's an amazing view.
The hotel was established in 2014 after Tyler left his native Korea.
I'm living to the island life, very peaceful, just everybody like friendly with the smiles. My dream.
Tyler specializes in diving tours, and before the pandemic, he catered mostly to Korean clients. But of course, COVID changed all of that. It's been several years since the pandemic, and in Palau, a country of under 20,000 people and nearly 1,000 kilometres from its nearest neighbours, tourism operators like Tyler are still waiting for a full recovery. In 2019, Palau received around 90,000 tourists. In 2022, less than 10,000. Driving around the main island of Koror, my taxi driver Daniel told me how things had changed.
Do you drive a lot of tourists, or mostly
not,
locals?
Not really.
Right. Did you have more tourists before?
Before pandemic?
Yeah, was it better then?
Yeah, of course. It was really good.
There used to be 4 direct flights from Korea per week, but now Koreans typically have to go through Taiwan, and the extra travel time is putting off a lot of people. The tourism minister, Nirai Balasmatul, told me he's been working with various countries, including Korea, to try to get regular flights up and running again. But the problem is that given Palau's size, it's low on a lot of carriers' priorities.
As soon as they started flying out, they wanted to start with the bigger markets. Obviously, Koreans, Japan is one of the number one destinations, and you got Singapore, then you've got Europe. We are typically at the end of that sort of discussion.
Flights and arrivals have been picking up slowly, but many tourism operators are wary of letting too many people back in at once and seeing their precious natural resources get used up. It's a mentality that's enshrined in the Palau Pledge, which every visitor signs in their passport when they arrive at Koror International Airport.
Children of Palau, I take this pledge as your guest to preserve and protect your beautiful and unique island home.
Ivory Vogt is a Palauan sustainable tourism consultant. We talked about how lots of the tour operators I spoke to in Palau told me they wanted to see tourism done in a managed way, even at the expense of revenue. She says it comes down to the culture.
The desire for more money is not necessarily the primal driver for us as Palauans to succeed in business. That's why maybe we're not kind of thinking about this endless growth model of tourism.
Tourism Minister Matul says he's pursuing strategies of spreading out tourism around the islands, while at the same time trying to create different strata of tourism services to bring in more revenue without increasing potentially ruinous footfall.
If I were to explain it like a plane, for many years we've had a lot of economy seats. And what we want to do is build a more robust tourism product where we've got some business and a lot of first-class seats. That's the challenge we're going through now, is how do we develop experiences that are meaningful to that segment and yet maintain a fixed number of tourists and maximize our revenues.
Nirai Balasmatul ending that report by Frey Lindsay in Palau. Now, time for the boss. Not the literal one, but this one.
Saw my reflection in a window and didn't know my own face. Oh, brother, are you gonna leave me wasting away on the streets of Philadelphia? There's a darkness on the edge of town.
The unmistakable sound of Bruce Springsteen and just a few of the American songwriter's numerous hits. He sold more than 140 million records, won 20 Grammys, an Oscar, a Tony, and last year he was honoured with the National Medal of Arts by President Joe Biden. Now, he's about to make history by becoming the first international songwriter to be awarded a UK Ivors Academy Fellowship. He joins Elton John, Paul McCartney, Joan Armatrading and Kate Bush in winning the prestigious prize. Julian Marshall spoke to the journalist Matt Charlton about what this award would mean for Springsteen.
The UK has always been a very big supporter of Bruce Springsteen. It didn't really take off for him straight away in the USA. It took until his third album, Born to Run, for it things to really kick in from there. But he made his name on the live circuit, and that included the UK. And like so many artists before and since, American artists, he went over to the UK and cut his teeth and got a really strong following. So it should mean quite a lot to him.
Because the citation reads, his impact on the UK's cultural landscape. How would you measure that?
He's always spoken to the blue-collar worker, which, of course, is a very American expression, but it hits in the same way here with the working class. It's about that struggle. It's about being ignored. It's about losing out and still seeing the romance in the rough edges. And he really pulls a lot of people together. The epitome of it and distilled down into one lyric is "Tramps like us, baby, we were born to run." You know, the two sides of what he does, the downtrodden and the overlooked and the tramps like us, and then the romance that comes with "we were born to run, we're going to soar anyway." And that really encapsulates it.
And we've been talking about the US-UK connection, but globally, do you think the same resonance?
Let's take his biggest hit, "Born in the USA." Now that appeals to flag-waving, MAGA cap-wearing people who haven't really listened to the lyrics. It's about how badly Vietnam vets were being treated. But then it also appealed to just anyone who wants to punch their fist in the air in a stadium. But it is, in many ways, quite anti-American dream.
Do you think the Ivors Academy is going to open its doors now to more non-British artists?
It's a nice thought, yes. It would be good if this wasn't a one-off and it went a bit deeper into what's been happening really over the last 30, 40 years with hip-hop, for example, because this isn't a new, challenging, new kid on the block genre. This has been around for a while and had a massive impact. It's the music of the 21st century.
Matt Charlton speaking to Julian Marshall. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Jancis Haycox, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.